All right, and welcome everyone to another Cancel the Cabal on peoplesinternetradio.com. I'm Stephen Roberts, and today I have a special returning guest, John Rachel, John D. Rachel. He's an author, and we are here to talk about his new book, The Peace Dividend. Welcome, John.
Good to be here. Thank you so much, Stephen.
Oh, yes. This is The Peaceful Dividend, the most controversial proposal in history of the world.
Well, it sounds like an exaggeration, but if you understand the proposal, you realize why I say it's the most controversial. Because what I'm asking in this book is for our government, the United States government, to admit its mistakes over the past 24 years, and to make amends to the American people. Well, we all know, we can read history, we know that all the way till time immemorial, kings and democracies and dictatorships, no government ever admits its mistakes, and no government ever turns around and does the right thing. It apologizes, makes excuses, says, gee, we could have done better, but it doesn't actually repair the damage that's been done. Yeah. So that's why I claim this is the most controversial proposal in history, because I'm saying to the U.S., I'll give you in a nutshell the premise of the book. In 1992, when the Soviet Union collapsed, the people of America were promised a peace dividend. This was, we'd been spending all this money fighting the Soviet Union, trying to maintain some sort of military superiority, wasting a lot of money on nuclear weapons and all sorts of armaments. Well, the Soviet Union literally disappeared overnight. And so that threat was gone. And I'm not saying this. It wasn't the newspapers. Politicians were saying, this is a great new beginning for America and for the world. We are now going to be the beneficiaries of a peace dividend. All this money we've been spending, we can now, a lot of it, I mean, you can't just close the Department of Defense, but a lot of that money will now be turned to making America an even better place, better communities, better schools, better roads. We will make America, I hate to use this, great again.
Okay,
but
Donald Trump.
But anyway, the point is, this is a promise. It was a verbal promise. It was a very hopeful time. I remember that time very well. Well, here's what's happened. Since 1992, the military budget actually went down a little bit for 8 years, but it went way up for 16 years. We have attacked 8 countries. We have wars all over the map. We have 900 military bases. I don't know if people really, 900 military bases in 145 countries all over the world.
I thought it was like 186 countries or something like that.
Maybe. There's only 194 countries. Yeah. So maybe they don't have one in Tonga and, you know.
The Isle of Man.
but the point is, here's what I'm saying. This is the biggest taxpayer ripoff in the history of mankind.
Yeah.
This is all money that we as taxpayers paid this money to the federal government believing and trusting that they would put this money to good use. And instead, they squandered it on a whole host of military junk, like the F-35, stuff that doesn't even work. We have blown money out the door on wars that never had to be fought. We have, while our infrastructure is crumbling in America, we have spent $160 billion building roads and bridges and schools and community centers in Afghanistan and Iraq. This is insanity. So we'll get now to the premise. I have added this up, and I'm talking about, this is a very conservative figure. I have used a lot of times the official figures, which are actually in themselves very deceptive.
Sure, yeah.
But you add up all of this money for 24 years, and it comes to $4.826 trillion. $1 trillion. Now, there's 322 million plus Americans as of July. So here's what I say. Let's not even dicker about this. We'll just take the three, that figure, divide it into that, and it comes out to $14,952 for every living U.S. citizen.
Yeah.
Man, woman, and child. I say this is our money. It was stolen from us. It was taken under fraudulent circumstances. We demand our money back. The peace dividend promised in 1992 has come due and payable. So that's what the book is about. It's saying to the people, stick up for yourselves. You could use that money. You could pay down your credit cards. You could replace the bald tires on your car. You could go out to dinner for a change instead of eating Doritos, you know.
I could put a real good down payment on a house for $14,000.
Exactly. This is money that we, as American citizens, will put to good use. Now, the book is only 86 pages long, but I get into how this can be funded, how it's good for the economy, how it's good for America to stop wasting money, making more trouble in the world, creating more enemies, and creating an America that is stronger at home. You know, when you think about it, sometimes economists refer to this as helicopter money. You just give money to the public. Well, it's not helicopter money. It's actually our money coming back to us because we were sold a defective product. And that money, America's economy is 70% consumer economy. That's money that, you know, I don't know about you. I would spend it. I'll spend it on things I need. And so that goes right back into the economy. This is what creates jobs. This is what creates an economy with some vitality, because, and part of my plan, I don't want to make it too complicated. Part of my plan is to actually refund this money in something called U.S. peace dollars, which is domestic use only currency. So this is currency that can only be spent within the United States of America on domestically created goods and services. So this is very, very, this, all these, you know, the candidates say, oh, we need more jobs and we need more of this and more. This is a real way to actually revitalize the economy of America.
Yeah.
And it's doing it with our own money. I mean, sure. People forget tax dollars is not the U.S. government's money. It's our money.
Or so a lot of people think that way anyways. But why do you think they would, why do you think the American government would actually have broken down like that and maybe seemingly to get a conscience and want to make some sort of a contract like that, John?
I don't think that anybody in office would go along with this, which is why we need regime change in Washington, D.C. I mean, I live in Japan. I get a very different version of the news than what you get there.
I'm certainly,
And I'm telling you, it's like standing outside of a mental institution looking into what's going on there.
Believe me, it's like looking in a mental institution here too, though.
Well, and this is the thing, is that people, I know that people understand there's a problem, but they're constantly bombarded by just this insane propaganda. And, you know, I mean, I post my stuff on Facebook and most people agree with me because, you know, as my friends typically sign up as friends because they understand my political views. But I get these raving lunatics, you know, who think that America's on the right track. Yeah, we need to bomb Russia. We need to bomb China. And it's like, what reality do these people live in? You know, this is insane.
They live in good old boy Redneckville, I think.
But you know what? I don't judge people in that. Well, I'm not saying you shouldn't, but I'm just saying I lived in America most of my life. I took my wife back to America, my Japanese wife, 4 years ago. America, for the most part, most people are good people just trying to live, raise their kids, have a nice community, have a nice family. You know, most people are not in favor of these crazy policies that the United States government has embraced. This is the product of a core of power-mad corporate plutocrats that have inserted themselves, and I go into this in the book. I identify them by name, just some of the people that have infected the U.S. government like a disease and are driving this. If American people really understood the inner workings and what's driving this, there would probably be a violent revolution in America. But I'm not calling for that. I'm calling for Americans just to say, look at the mess we're in. Look how it's hurting you. Understand that all of this constant warmongering and need for bigger and badder military is completely a fraud.
Yeah. Do you know, John, that there's a movement over here in America? There are a certain number of people. I don't know that number yet, but they are starting almost a class action suit. Like, they want to be able to sue the government and have a stipulation put in the Constitution that if you don't want these wars and you don't want all this military-industrial complex to grow like a sumo wrestler, you can pretty much opt out of your taxes.
Wow.
Yeah.
That would be powerful if you could get people. I think people are afraid to do something like that.
Yeah, well.
Because, you know, most people don't want their house to be repossessed by federal agents, you know.
Or they don't want the SWAT teams brought upon them.
I mean, that's the reality. So, you know, what I'm suggesting here is a very simple stand. Just take your stand. We want our money back. We know, don't even argue with us. We know you ripped us off. We want our money back. So you say to your, you know, it's election time. You say to your congressman, are you for this or are you against it? And he's, of course, going to say, oh, well, this is really outrageous and we can't afford this. Are you for it or are you against it? We don't want to talk about it. We're asking a simple question, yes or no. If you're against it, we're not going to vote for you. That's it.
Well, that's why.
Take a stand.
That's why they call it political rhetoric, because they know that they're deceiving us with their words. They know that they just have to say anything they have to get into office and then do as they please once they get in.
So why aren't people more angry about this? I mean, I don't even live there. I'm angry about it.
It's fear. So, it's fear.
It's fear.
Yeah. A lot of people are coming to the realization and they are learning that a U.S. citizen doesn't have to pay federal taxes. Federal taxes are only for corporations, but yet millions of people still pay for their taxes, and they do it out of fear. They don't want to get that SWAT team. They don't want their house repossessed, or they don't want the IRS taking everything that they have.
So why don't they battle them at the ballot box?
Well, ballot boxes can be changed at their
true.
Whim.
That's a whole other issue. I agree. That is probably the biggest challenge.
Look over here. There was the 2012 election, Barack Obama's second election. There was two counties. One, the county that encompasses Philadelphia and the county that encompasses Cleveland. Statistically speaking, over 99% of the people in those counties voted for Barack Obama. You know, as far as I'm concerned, that's fraud because it didn't happen.
Right. Exactly. I mean, yeah, you're right. This is a whole other program, a whole other discussion. And I don't know how we address that because these voting machines are completely rigged.
So
there's no question about that.
That's why I don't vote anymore, to tell you the truth.
So you think that
there's already been a couple reports that kind of slipped, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. That Hillary has already won the election.
Well, I have no doubt that she has. And this is another thing, by the way. I don't know whether I really get a lot of flack about this, but this whole presidential election is just a reality show. I mean, yes, the president is very powerful, but you know what? You look at a guy like Adelson, you know who he is? He's like the one of the richest men in the country. He made his money on gambling casinos.
Right.
And he's the one who backs all these right-wing candidates. Adelson, his
yeah.
name is.
Yeah.
Where does he put, is he?
Well, the Koch brothers do too, I think.
And the Koch brothers, where do they put their money? They're not worried about the presidential campaign.
No.
They put their money in congressional campaigns.
It's all a write-off for them anyways.
Huh?
It's all a write-off for them anyways.
Exactly. But the point is they know where the power to make the laws is in Congress, not in the White House. Yes, the White House can veto, but you put in a veto-proof Congress and you can get anything done. It doesn't matter if it's Ted Nugent or Lady Gaga sitting in the White House. We will pass laws because that's what the Congress does. So that's where the power is. And people don't understand that and this is why I've been calling for 4 years now, I've been calling for regime change in Congress. I had a thing going on called Throw the Bums Out. And it's just literally about 500 of these people, senators and House and representatives alike, need to go because they are completely on the payroll of the corporate plutocrats, the 0.01% that really run this country.
Yes.
So if we don't replace them, all of these initiatives about constitutional amendment, nothing gets done. All of that stuff has to start and it has to go through the legislative process.
Certainly. Can you repeat your characterization of Congress there, what you said a few minutes ago? Not Congress, but this particular political system.
Well, it's an established fact. There's a Princeton study a year and a half ago that looked at the results of 30 years of legislation, and they said America is no longer a democracy; it's a oligarchy. An oligarchy is when a tiny group of powerful, rich people run things, and that's what we have in this country.
Well,
the Congress that we have, almost to a man, are on the payroll of the rich, powerful elite.
One of the one or all of the military industries, military corporations. They have contracts. Yeah.
Exactly.
No, but I meant you had a certain characterization for this political system, and I forgot what that was.
I'm sorry, I did too.
Well, I can't remember what it was, but I was thinking at the time, you called it that, but I call it an actual circus, because that's what it seems to me is nothing but a circus.
I said the presidential race was a reality show.
That's what it was, yeah.
Well, I didn't watch the debate, but I read summaries because I won't waste my time watching a buffoon and a sociopath, take cheap shots at one another. But I read the summaries, and the critical issues, the real issues, the ones raised, some of them raised by Bernie Sanders, for example, none of them were even discussed. Why can't people who work at McDonald's or the people that work at Home Depot or whatever, why can't they make a livable wage?
Yeah.
That's a very basic issue. Yeah. You know, if you're working 40 hours or 35 hours a week, you should be able to make enough money to have a decent life. You shouldn't have to work two or three jobs. That wasn't brought up in the debates.
I got my first job in 1982. I didn't make much of anything. I really can't remember what the minimum wage was back then. It was like $2.45 or something like that. But I lived like a king. And my second job, I started out like $5.25 an hour, because that was a factory starting out rate. You know, within 6 months, I was at $7 an hour. And I bought a brand new car and a brand new motorcycle, and I was having a ball at the age of 19.
Isn't that amazing to think about? 19, and that was in the early 80s.
Uh-huh.
So I'm about twice as old as you. My parents in the 50s You know, my mom was incredibly sick. I don't even know what kind of insurance, what they had. But my mom was in and out of the hospital all the time. My dad worked as a hardware clerk. So you know he wasn't making six figures, right? We had a nice home, nice car. They always bought me great toys at Christmas. They spoiled me. They're our only child. People had a good, decent life just working, or, you know, ordinary jobs.
Single family or a single income family. Yeah.
Exactly. So what's, you know, if you look at that picture and, if, you know, the problem is it's been a very slow kind of degradation of the American dream. And so now our expectations are so low that, you know, we feel we're lucky if we can get a 30-hour shift at some fast food restaurant with no benefits, no vacation. This is ridiculous. This is the richest country in the world, and this is how its citizens have to survive. There's like over 40 million people living in poverty in America. Nah. 1 in 5 children go to bed hungry. Yeah. This is unconscionable.
Yeah.
So my book, The Peace Dividend, says a lot of this comes from the militarism, this idea by a lot of power crazy people that the U.S. has to police the whole world, that we have to run the world, that we have to be the supreme superpower. This is an enormous waste of our resources. It's draining the country. So we need to put a stop to it.
Yes, we do. Absolutely. I do like the fact that there are some movements coming to America that are just, well, just people just stop paying their federal taxes just because of all these things that we are talking about, these wars and all this attrition and the rape and the pillage of these elite families that control the banks, that control the governments.
You know, you seem like a really decent human being, and probably all of your listeners are decent human beings. I'm sure that you, like me, find it inconceivable that these people that have so much want more. They seem to want it all. If we were living in mud and starving to death, it wouldn't bother them at all as long as they could buy another country home or another villa.
Another yacht.
You know,
yeah.
I don't understand these people. I've never met anybody like this, but they are there. And this is something that people have to understand.
Well,
the rich are not like you and I. They are selfish, self-centered people who view the rest of us as a bunch of pigs.
They
don't care about us.
They run in tight groups and they have big armed bodyguards that keep people like us away from them.
So either we take back, they're not going to give us anything. What they're going to do is they're going to dish out more excuses and more lies and more things to make us feel better about the way things are going. But they're not going to actually give us anything. We're going to have to take the power back. And this has been the thrust of the last three books I've written. I wrote a book called Candidate Contracts, which we talked about before, and then one called Taking Back or Fighting for the Democracy We Deserve. And by the way, this peace dividend idea was contained as just a small part of those two books. But I decided that especially lately now we're talking about going to war with Russia and China, which is insanity. Neither of those countries want war with America. I guarantee you, regardless of what anybody hears on television, Russia and China do not want war. They just want their piece of the pie. They just want to. I've been to Russia and I've been to China. You know, yes, every country has its pros and it has its cons. But I'll tell you a story about Russia. My wife and I were in St. Petersburg, Russia, and we happened to go there on a weekend when they were having one of their big national holidays. It was a celebration of the naval history and the naval power of Russia. And St. Petersburg, of course, is on, you know, has a big river running through it. So in the river are, there's a couple submarines and there's these battleships, and there's tens of thousands of people everywhere. Everywhere you turn, there were mobs of people. Guess what I didn't see?
What's that?
Police. I didn't see a single police officer. Think about that. Can you have 50,000 people get together in America without the police showing up dressed up like they're ready for battle in Iraq? And you have, you know, with their tasers and their guns and their batons, and, you know, these countries are nothing like what they're portrayed to be in the West. They just simply are not. I lived in Vietnam, a communist country, for 6 months.
Yeah.
It's nothing like what people, what, you know, we say, oh, we had to keep them, you know, we killed 3 million Vietnamese trying to keep them from going communist. We lost the war. We killed off 58,000 of our own young men and women losing that war. And you can go to Vietnam now and you eat their spicy noodles and people are nice. And, you know, it's like any other country. It's developing. They're trying to rebuild their country. But it's not like America where you've got people getting shot for answering their door. It's nothing like that. I very rarely saw police in Vietnam. They have a little bit of a crime problem. They have pickpockets, and if you're walking down the street, they might try to grab your purse or your handbag. That's normal, but they won't put a bullet in the back of your head because they're desperate.
Right, right.
So people need to wake up and understand that America, at the rate it's going, is becoming a police state. It's taking all of the power and militarism that it projects on the rest of the world, and now it's turning it on Americans themselves.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to say that it's not becoming a police state. It is a police state.
Well, you're there. You know. Thank God I'm not there.
Yeah.
So, you don't vote?
No, not anymore. No, since I hate to say it because it's not really a good characterization, but that the when I had my awakening type of a moment, I came to the realization that there's no difference between the two sides. They are marching left foot and right foot towards tyranny and towards police state.
So when did that realization come about?
I think probably around March of 2009.
Wow. Okay. I thought you were gonna say 1986.
No.
Because it's been true for a long time.
Yeah.
You know?
I
woke up in 1996, and I'm not trying to, you know,
yeah,
say I'm smarter than you. I'm just saying that I caught a few speeches, and one of them was Ralph Nader, and he said, you know, this system is a joke, this duopoly. You've got two wings of the same political party. And I went, wow, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And I started that. So it made me look at things differently. And I started realizing what he said. But at that time, I still held out hope that maybe we could generate some interest in the public in changing things. But I respect your decision to not vote. I totally respect it because, frankly, it's an exercise in futility.
Yes. Well, that, you know, it's been said that, it's a rhetorical device, but it's put out there a lot that the phrase is, if you don't vote, you don't have nothing to complain about. Well, it's just the opposite. You look at the legal definitions of a lot of these things that we do. Protesting is actually crying about something after the fact that is already done and can't be, it can be remedied, but it's quite difficult. To protest, I think effectively you don't vote for the left tyranny or the right tyranny, and you voice your opinion beforehand.
Well, you've given the justification for my vote, which I voted green since 1996. People say you're throwing your vote away, but I refuse to endorse the insanity of the Republican and Democratic parties. Yeah. I just refuse to endorse it. So what am I going to do? I'm going to vote for somebody I can believe. And I think Jill Stein, even though she's just a sweet, sweet lady and is not going to win, at least I can sleep at night saying, you know, I voted for someone who, if she were elected, would actually do great things for this country. So I understand. I mean, I guess in a way I'm kind of not voting because I'm throwing my vote away in some people's view.
Plus you're in Japan.
Well, you know, and I get that a lot. I get that positive and negative. People say, oh, you're so lucky. And I am. I live a fairy tale life. I live in a little traditional rural community about an hour and a half from Osaka. On one side of me is soybean fields. In front of my house is a rice field. I ride my bicycle through the village and all the little Japanese. It's a very old community, so all the old people wave at me and bow. It's wonderful. But the point is, I still deeply care about America. It is my country. It is my passport, my citizenship. I'm an American. I have friends. I have a daughter and grandchildren back there. I don't want to see the country go down, you know, end up in the sewer. And this is what's happening. And it just astounds me. My daughter is completely and totally blind to everything that's going on there. She lives in one of these plastic suburban communities outside of Atlanta. It has not a clue as to what a mess the country is.
She can't see outside her paradigm, can she?
Well, and that's the way they want to keep it. They want to keep people focused on, and you know what? But when you think about it, that's all we should be able to focus on. We should be able to focus on our immediate family, our neighborhood, our community. That's what we should, as citizens, pay attention to. But unfortunately, they're taking advantage of our preoccupation. And now, of course, just having a healthy family, keeping food on the table, keeping the car running, is becoming more difficult. So it becomes such an overwhelming preoccupation that people don't have time. They don't have time to read policy papers and read congressional hearing transcripts. They just don't. They trust their politicians to do the right thing. And in an ideal world, that's how democracy should work. But as you say, you know, it doesn't matter who you vote for. They go in, as soon as they get inside the Washington, D.C. bubble, amnesia sets in. And then the lobbyists start coming in their office. Tens of thousands of these people. The campaign donations start coming in. I mean, most congressmen even say, my biggest complaint about this job is that I spend more time raising money for my next campaign than I do actually paying attention to my job, which is passing laws. And so that money starts rolling in, and all of a sudden, the voters, the people that voted these guys into office, they're completely and totally forgotten. And that's why nothing gets done that we want done. I mean, I can cite you statistics that are shocking. And I'll give you the most shocking one. 93% of Americans. Now, 93%, this means that you have to cut across all party lines and all ideological. We're talking about conservatives and liberals and communists and socialists and Tea Party and anarchists. 93% of Americans want labeling of GMOs on their food. This is not to ban GMOs, just to say, you read a label. What does it say? It says corn syrup, and it says, you know,
sugar,
artificial flavor. Yeah, the first ingredients are always fat, sugar, and more fat. But anyway, exactly. At least it tells you what's in there. So you can say, okay, do I want to give this to my kids? And you cannot get through Congress legislation that just says, put GMO on the label.
Yeah.
Well, what does that tell you?
Yeah.
That tells you that the Congress is owned by the agrochemical industries, the people that are producing these products. So that's just a simple illustration, and you can go across the board. 79% of people want Social Security left alone. So every Congress, they attack it. They talk about privatizing it. People want Medicare left alone. People want a higher minimum wage. 74% of people want at least $12.50 an hour, and something like 68%, that's a huge majority, want $15 an hour.
Yeah.
You can't get it through Congress. So this has got it. These statistics tell the story.
Yeah.
People want things done. They don't get done. People don't want these. So the statistics tell the story. I mean, you look at Social Security and Medicare and minimum wage and all these things. People know what they want. And I'll tell you something else that they know. They know they don't want a bunch of unnecessary wars. And that was shown in 2013 when the American public said, do not bomb Syria. There was just an enormous number of people that wrote Congress and phoned in and said, So that was an example that shows that people, they know there's something funny about this need to bomb every country.
Well, the internet has been, it's been a two-edged sword with the government. They invented it for communications and between their agencies and the military. But I think Senator Rockefeller said it best. He said, we should have never made the internet available to the public because it's been our greatest downfall. And it has. It's been a two-edged sword. It's been their greatest invention and their greatest downfall because, you know, there don't seem to be all of the people here in America are paying attention, but there are enough of us here paying attention to where we're trying to get the word out. And we are starting to, I think, become effective here in the last couple of years.
So now I'm going to whine a little bit. No, I'm serious. I'm going to whine. I'm in contact with people on the left all the time. Peace activists, you know, progressives, etc. And let me tell you what I see.
I just want to inject something real quick so I don't forget. I remember all of the anti-war protesters when George Bush was in office, and they seem to have been silent for the last 7.5 years. Very, very silent. There was a lot of anti-war movies that come out of Hollywood, and there hasn't been any anti-war movies. They've been pro-war movies coming out of Hollywood. So go ahead.
I think that's very intentional. It's part. It's
sure it
it's
is
something that's, you know, we're finding out now that the CIA and the DOD actually are very, very, what shall we say? They're sort of co-creators of a lot of these America, bomb the world types of movies that are coming out in great numbers now. But what I started to say is what I and you're right, there has been a deafening silence when it comes to protesting wars. And this is why I wrote The Peace Dividend, because I think what's happened, I listen to these people all the time, and I told you I was going to whine a little bit. And here's my whining. People on the left and the peace activists love to talk and talk and talk and talk about this is the problem. This is where it's coming from. This is, they analyze and they argue and they talk in all this convoluted language about what the problem is. Nobody ever proposes a solution. I think protests are very important. And I think getting out on the streets and giving a message is vital, but you have to have a message to give.
Yeah.
And you can't just flash a peace sign and say, well,
wouldn't peace be nice?
Yeah.
Because that doesn't do anything. Yeah. Everybody would agree with that. So what?
Certainly it would. I'm going to pass you some memes through Skype here, John. You can look at them at your leisure, but I made these things up and they're pretty, I think they're quite poignant and I think they're quite funny myself. So I don't know. Tell me what you think. I'm just going to pass these to you.
Let's see here. Or you're sending me attachments. Okay.
And Skype, yeah.
Hippie too.
Yeah, they're a liberal hippie meme and hippie number two, yeah.
Okay, now, they change Skype every time I use it. They put a new upgrade. I'm trying to figure out how do I see these.
Are they? You should be able to click on a link and
I know, but I accept them.
But
I'm trying to get my screen to expand so I can see the links. Ah, here we go. Ah, okay. Hippie. I love this.
But anyways, yeah, I mean, there's a method to my madness. There's a point for, it seems, well, there was a anti-war movement when, I can't say it was an anti-war movement when Bill Clinton was in office because there wasn't any wars, but seems like all of the Republican presidents want to promote war and the liberal left want to protest them. But when a liberal president comes into office and starts wars and creates them and promotes them, they seem to be silent.
Well, Bill Clinton took Yugoslavia apart.
Yeah, and Chechnya.
Obama took Libya and destroyed Libya. So I don't see it as a Republican versus Democrat issue. It's just whoever's in office and whatever convenient targets are available.
Yeah, that's
that's what gets done.
Well,
oh my God, wars are so cool. This is great.
Yeah.
When a Republican wins the post, I will become anti-war again. That's a very good point. I mean, the thing is, I believe that there's something called the deep state. And the deep state is not a conspiracy. It's Bill Moyers had a phenomenal article on this. And it's basically, when you change the presidency, you're changing maybe 200-300 people. You know, his direct appointees. But underneath that are tens of thousands of people that continue on in their civil service job. These are State Department officials. These are people that work for the Department of Defense. These are people that work for the NSA, the CIA, the FBI, all of the agencies of the Homeland Security. All those people stay in place. And people tend to do things today the way they did them yesterday. So you have this enormous amount of momentum that is already created. You have a certain mindset that exists regardless of who the president is. And it is that mindset that has become fanatic, religiously fanatic about America being the world empire. And that's what drives all of this. So to my view, if you read any of the documents produced in the 90s, all of this stuff, all of the countries that were destroying, they were all targeted back in the 90s. This isn't something that happened after 9/11. Everybody knew this was coming. So the point is, this is what we need to change. We need regime change. And that means if a strong, progressive, anti-war president ever gets elected, and it's unlikely, there's going to be an enormous house cleaning that has to take place. And it has to go way into the deep state. And if it doesn't, again, that person will just be rendered powerless. And this is what I tried to explain to people about even the Bernie Sanders people. I said, you know what? You want Bernie Sanders to be your president, but don't you understand what's going to happen if he becomes president and you leave Congress the way it is right now? He's not going to get anything done. It's going to make our previous gridlock look like a tea party. Or I don't want to use tea party. It'll look like a birthday party for a 2-year-old, because they're not going to enact any legislation that he wants enacted. It's just going to be a war between the Congress and the White House. In fact, you'll probably have a bipartisan block, Republicans and Democrats, fighting this socialist that the crazy American people put in into the White House. And so people have to understand this is not, there's no simple solution to this. It involves a vast change in the personnel and the mindset of Washington, D.C. But it's going to have to come from the people, because those people in power, they're not going to change. You know, I love it when people say, oh, we need campaign finance reform. Do you think the people that are benefiting from the current finance laws, campaign, are going to change the laws? Of course not. You have to change those people to get campaign finance
reform. That's right. That's right. The well, they get virtually 100% of their of their yearly earnings once they retire or once they leave Congress.
How come you and I didn't get that deal? What's going on here?
Hard telling, hard telling.
So I'm just doing what I can from my little sleepy village in Japan. I'm just saying to people, you know, this confrontation between the U.S. and now all this saber rattling about Russia is suicide. Russia, I don't care what you think of Putin. He's a strong leader. He's a dictator, whatever. You know, I don't want to even get into that argument. But the point is, they have their national interests. They have their people. The Russian people are, they're kind of rough around the edges in some ways, but they produce great art, beautiful architecture, great dance, great music. They have an amazing culture and history and nation that they are proud of. And they're not going to let the U.S. destroy their nation. That's that simple.
Oh, yes.
And the other thing people have to understand, there's two things they have to understand. The U.S. and England did not win World War II. It was the Russians. The Russians lost 27 million people in World War II. And they were attacked by an insane fascist dictator, yes, but they look at it in very simple terms. Any country that attempts to attack and destroy Russia is going to be met with the fiercest opposition, that even if that means nuclear war. So this talk that we're hearing bandied about now is Russia's got to go and Putin's got to go and, you know, we can't tolerate. Who is America to say who they can tolerate and who they can't? Russia is not buzzing our borders with jet fighters. They're not setting up troops, bases
They're not funding terrorism either.
And they're not funding terrorism. Russia has 10 military bases around the world, and all of those external bases are at the request of the countries that host those bases. These are countries that say, we would like your military assistance for our, you know, to increase our military strength in our own country. So China has one military base outside of its own country. One. And did you, Djibouti, or however you say it, in the Middle East. One. America has over 900. Who's the aggressor? Why can't Americans see that they are being set up for the most disastrous confrontation in the history of the world? And guess what?
Well,
we're the ATM machine for this. We're the taxpayers funding this insanity.
Exactly. Well, because we have the master manipulators on the TV screen and the radio stations telling us that, you know, you have to be red, white, and blue Yankee Doodle Dandies.
Well, you know what? I think red, white, and blue Yankee Doodle Dandies means taking care of our own citizens, providing good health care, which America is way down on the list. I live in Japan. I got an operation in South Korea on my spine. Unbelievable. Unbelievable good. The best technology, the best medical care you can imagine. cost me one-fifth of what it would have cost me in America. We need good schools, you know, instead of taking our schools apart and turning them into corporate assets and privatizing them. We need good college education. We need opportunities for kids. We need a country where kids don't come out of college with $50,000 worth of debt. This is
$50,000. How about $250,000?
Well, whatever it is, you know.
Yeah.
So this is what's being a good Yankee Doodle Dandy guy is saying: let's make our country a country that we can live in, thrive in, be proud of. So, and as I, you know, I'm trying to frame all of this. You know, we can talk for hours and hours and hours because it's all a big, complex, convoluted mess. I'm trying to frame it in just simple, stark terms. America citizens, taxpayers have been taken to the cleaners for 24 years. It's time for us to take a stand and demand that money back.
Why do you think it's just been 24 years?
Well, it isn't. It's been much more, but I'm saying at least this provides a framework. The whole idea of the peace dividend was created by our own government spokespersons in 1992. So I'm saying just taking it from there. Yeah, we could go back all the way to the Korean War, for God's sakes. But I don't want to make this. If you were to look at the amount of money that's actually been wasted, it would probably be $20 trillion, which we could never afford to pay back. But you know what? We can actually afford to pay back $4.82 trillion. I show exactly how it can be done. I'm writing a blog right now, and I will show you exactly how that money can be paid back without bankrupting the economy. In fact, invigorating our economy by doing this. And yes, it's going to be much higher taxes on the rich, much higher, steeper taxes, capital gains. It's going to be transaction taxes on Wall Street. The casino capitalism is going to, if they're going to continue with that, they're going to pay their fair share. Yes, it's going to attack offshoring of jobs and offshoring of huge amounts of wealth. It's going after all that money. There are ways to pay for this. It is a transfer of money that was stolen from us, from the rich back to the everyday people. It should come to a lot more than $14,952. But that's at least the start. I mean, a family of four would get almost $60,000. As you say, you know, that's a down payment on a house, you know. That's being able to pay down our credit cards, put some, you know, stop having to put off that vacation we've been putting off for 10 years. So this is why I've only limited to 24 years, is because this is just one framework. There's many frameworks that we could put this within, but this is one framework that makes sense, that everybody can understand this. They can see, oh my God, this is what's happened. This is the way our money's being used.
Yeah.
So that's why I limited it to 24 years, just, shall we say, for the sake of argument, as a good place to start. You know, we have to start somewhere. And I don't see any message, compelling message out there coming from the peace movement or from progressives or anybody. They just say, oh, we need to fix this. Well, how do you fix it when the mechanisms of power, that is the White House and the Congress and even the Supreme Court, are locked up by the rich and wealthy? How do you fix it? Well, you fix it by starting at the ground roots level. And the battle cry should be, we want our money back. That should be the meme for the next election. And the congressmen that say, okay, I'll go along with it, fine. You go along with that. You sign a contract committing to do that. You got our vote. You don't sign it, you don't agree to this, we will find somebody who will. And there are a lot of good people out there who would make 10 times better congressmen than what we have. You know, in Finland, they have a system of democracy where the people that sit in the legislature are everyday people. You might be, you know, you might be a taxi driver, and then you are elected to congressman, and the taxi company has to hold your job. You can't be fired, so that when you get out of Congress, you come back and your job's waiting for you. Think about this. They have regular people going to Congress, passing the laws for the people of the country, not for the corporations. This is possible. Yeah, it's a complex world and legislation. That's why you have a staff. You have people that study all this stuff. But the point is, you put people in office that are actually representing the people, not representing their fat cat donors and their Wall Street sponsors.
Yes, yes. You know, I there's been a movement, and part of the entertainment system is picking up on this movement. People are starting to assert their own sovereignty. People are starting to take back the power. They're, you know, it's made fun of, John. It's called getting off the grid, getting off the system, getting away from the system, and it's made fun of. But I think the movement, you know, it works for me, and I want to get healed up physically and spiritually, and I want to do that myself. I want to stop feeding this beast and get off this system.
Well, I am in 100% agreement with you, and I used to own a 3,600 square foot house in Portland, Oregon. I had employees, and I had 12 landlines and cell phones and 9 computers and 2 cars and da, 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 da. Okay, I got off the grid in my own way. I don't even own a cell phone. I have no credit cards. I have no credit card debt. None of that. So, and I'll tell you what, I'm happier. If it weren't for all this political stuff, I'll tell you, I'm happier than I have ever been in my whole life getting off that treadmill. The only problem with that is you need to have a lot of people do that, because you're going to have to support one another. You're going to have, you know, local markets. You're going to have maybe have local currency, you know, barter currency. You're going to have to create a whole infrastructure to support what you're talking about. But the awakening process, you do individually. And I think that is brilliant and admirable. And if you're one of those people, I'm honored to meet you, seriously.
Well, as I said, when I get healed up physically and spiritually, I will be. I won't be feeding this beast any longer. I haven't paid any federal taxes in quite a few years because I am on disability, but... you know, if I can farm for myself, I wouldn't pay anything at their corporate stores that feed us nothing but junk.
Well, you know, and that, you've actually made a very interesting point. Let's get it getting out of the political realm. People don't realize that the most powerful tool for change is right in their pocket or in their wallet.
That's
right.
Where
they carry their money. Every time you spend a dollar, you know, to buy Roundup or to support these mega corporations that are destroying the planet, you are feeding the beast.
Yep.
So it's a simple decision. You know, you take that dollar and you spend it wisely and you spend it morally. And guess what? You starve those companies.
That's
they
right.
will either go out of existence or they will change.
Or they'll change their ways. Exactly.
But people don't realize that is that may even be more important than my peace dividend book. I mean, I'm trying to deal with militarism, the government, and policies that geopolitically are threatening the existence of our country. But the point is that in terms of these transnational corporations, now I hear that Bayer, which is an awful company, is buying Monsanto, which is an awful company. So now we have the synergy of two horrible companies working together.
Yeah.
I mean, This is insane. Yep. So what do? You get a list of all the products of those companies and you don't ever buy them. I don't care what happens. You never, ever buy those products. You starve those beasts.
Yep, exactly. Well, that brings us to the hour, John.
Okay.
It's been a nice quick hour there.
Wow, thank you. I guess I talk a lot, eh?
Yeah, both of us do, I think. But,
so let me take a bathroom break. And are we done or you want to do another hour? Or?
Well, I would just as soon be done right now, yeah.
Cool. And thank you. This is great. I love
Yeah, so we'll just take a break here and come back for some more.